The views expressed on Science for the People are not necessarily the views of this station, its affiliates, sponsors, or advertisers.
Hello, and welcome to Science for the People. I'm Desiree Schell, and today's episode looks at women in science. Later on in the show, we'll talk to Zara Zahari about her research into women's participation in science, technology, engineering, and math fields. But let's start out the episode with a very specific woman in science, one that's captured many people's hearts and imaginations, and see just how much of her legend is actually based on fact. Hello, and welcome to Science for the People. I'm joined now by Faith L. Justice, freelance writer and novelist. She's a science geek and history junkie, which explains why her short stories are mostly science fiction and fantasy, while her novels are all, so far, historical fiction. We're here today to talk about her book, Hypatia, Her Life and Times. Faith, thanks for being here.
Well, thank you for having me.
Now, not everyone listening will have heard of Hypatia, so without getting into too much detail right now, who was she? Why might people recognize her name?
Lately, she's become kind of a rock star among a lot of scientists, mathematicians, feminists, because she was a woman who was a very well-known mathematician and philosopher in the early 5th century. So, when you're trying to find heroes, and there aren't very many of them, she comes up.
How did you become interested in her?
I went to an art exhibit called The Dinner Party, which was put together by a woman named Judy Chicago and several of her associates. And Hypatia was featured in this particular art exhibit. She had her own place, so she had a plate and a runner, as did all the women who were featured down through history in this art exhibit. And at the time, I didn't know her, but I knew lots of the other people. I knew there were some goddesses, and there were lots of authors and other folks. And her name just stood out as one like, where did she come from? How did I manage to not see her? And I bought the accompanying catalog, and I looked up her name and read her history, and it was just fascinating. It said that she was a Roman philosopher, mathematician, who was into goddesses, and because of that, at the time, she was murdered by a Christian mob. And I went, oh, that's horrible and exciting, and decided that I wanted to know more about her. And that was 1980, and I spent like the next 17 years or so just finding out as much as I could, where I could, and quite frankly, there wasn't much out there, and a lot of it was very contradictory.
And that's what's so interesting about Hypatia, because she's been, let's say, adopted by a number of different groups. Scientists claim her as theirs, and so do atheists, and so do feminists. And you do talk about that in your book. So What gives each of these groups the impression that she's theirs?
I'll start with the feminists, because that was where I started from. And again, it was one of those things where here was a woman who was very well known during her time, and she absolutely was adored by a lot of people, and she had a lot of power. She was a woman that the governors would come and talk to before they took over their role as, governor of Alexandria. The church fathers talked with her. She was considered like a major mover and shaker in ancient Alexandria, but then she was murdered, and a lot of people thought that she was murdered because she was a woman, and that was their takeaway from the story. Scientists saw not only a woman, but they saw a scientist. She was a mathematician. She was an astronomer. And a lot of the stories that come out there come from the Cosmos series. Carl Sagan actually talked a lot about her in the Cosmos series, and a lot of people were introduced to her from him. And again, it was like, okay, here was a scientist. And guess what? She was murdered. And why was she murdered? Because she, there was all these superstitious people. And once she was murdered, science went into a major decline, and we had what the so-called Dark Ages. So scientists grab her. Kind of neo-pagans take her story, and they say, here was a woman who was a pagan, and she was murdered by Christians. So they take that from the story. And to some extent, they're all true. She was a woman. She was a scientist. And she was a pagan, although, as we'll probably discuss a little bit later, not a pagan in the traditional sense of the word.
Well, you mentioned that it was difficult to research Hypatia. Can you talk a bit about that?
Yeah, when I got into her story, I found that a lot of what I was reading were modern meaning like in the last three centuries, mm-hmm. writers, and they had really romanticized her. So I found out that, hey, she was married to a philosopher. No, she was married to a Christian. No, she wasn't married at all. She was a young woman. She was an old woman. She was a middle-aged woman. She was a Christian. She was a pagan. She was a free thinker. She was a free lover. No, she was, and it just goes on and on. You know, you just kind of pick which story you like, basically. Right. It was the way it came out. And I am not a classicist, so I didn't have access to the original work that there were about her. So, you know, as I got further into my research, I discovered there was very, very little that was actually written about her in the primary sources. And I think it comes to something like 16 pages printed, you know, all together. And quite frankly, a lot of that is repetitious. You know, it's like someone took what was written in the 5th century and then summarized it in the 8th, and then somebody summarized it in the 10th, and then somebody summarized it in the 12th. So there really are not that many primary sources out there on Hypatia. But I spent a lot of time learning about the times of Hypatia, and just found like very interesting, remarkable stuff on the development of the early church and what was going on in the Roman Empire at the time, and laws and daily life, and that stuff was just tons of fun as well. You know, even though I didn't have the story.
The writers of the time, they would have had reasons to be biased in their historical accounts as well, correct?
Oh, absolutely, because they were generally condemned. I mean, even the Christian writers were saying, what? You know, there was a mob of Christians who murdered this woman who was considered a pillar of her, pillar of society. That's not what Christians do. That just totally goes against, you know, our philosophy. So they were probably quite ashamed of what happened and, you know, managed to do a pretty good cover-up job of anything that was critical, but a few pages that were critical still got through.
So then how do you go about trying to separate the fact from the fiction? What makes something a credible source of historical information versus a biased account? Or mm-hmm. are they just all biased?
Everybody has their act to grind. I think the generally historians, and here again, I'm not a professional historian. Mm-hmm. I'm an amateur, but I've been working at it for like 20 years. So no degree, but lots of work in
right.
the area. But generally, historians look at who the person was who wrote the story, what was their political angle, if they had one. And the most extensive writing we have was from a man named Socrates, and that's not the philosopher who, you know, was murdered 800 years before that, but a man named Socrates, who was contemporary with Hypatia. And he wrote about 25 years after she died, and probably, like, you know, knew the stories directly, could do, eyewitness interviews, and he writes what generally seems to be a very balanced view of the story. And then it seems like nearly everybody else kind of summarizes what he said. The second other biggest source we have about Hypatia are letters written to her from one of her students named Synesius, who then became Bishop of Ptolemais. And his letters are fascinating, and they were all preserved. And I think there's like 150-some letters, and a handful of them are addressed directly to her. Several of them also refer to her. So no writing by Hypatia it survives. So we don't have any of her words that we can say, this is what she said, this is what she wrote. So we have to look at other people and what they're saying about her, and why are they saying it. And Synesius loved Hypatia, just adored her, and that just comes out, you know, through all his letters. And his letters are available online in translation, so anybody can go read them. Socrates, who was a contemporary but wrote in a different city, probably had access to eyewitnesses. So those are like the two best ones that we have.
This is Science for the People, and I'm here with Faith L. Justice, author of Hypatia, Her Life and Times. Okay, well, let's dig into Hypatia's life. What have you learned about her? Maybe walk us through her life.
The first thing you need to know is that there is a lot of controversy over when she was born. Originally, a lot of historians put her age at death around 45, and she was killed in 415 AD, and so that would have made her birth date around 370. However, there are other historians who have since come out and said, well, gee, that doesn't make a whole lot of sense, because we know that Synesius was her student, Hamilton, he was born probably around 370, and we know this because he was made a bishop, and you had to be at least 30 years old to become a bishop, because that was a law, etc. And there are some other dates having to do with her father that are also known. So now there's a lot of controversy over that, and so people are thinking that she was probably born before 370, as early as 350, maybe 355, but it's likely that she was like in her 50s up to about, you know, age 50 when she was killed in 415. She was the daughter of Theon, who is like the last attested member of the great Museum of Alexandria. He was primarily a mathematician, although he did do some philosophizing, but he was known primarily as a mathematician. And we know nothing about her mother, nothing at all, just, you know, her father. And he actually attributed some of his work to her. He said in one of the surviving texts has come down to us that my philosopher daughter, Hypatia, helped me with this chapter in his book. So we do know that they work together. She became very well known for her philosophy and for her mathematic work and her astronomy. She put together a local group of students. And I say local meaning that they lived in Alexandria and attended her. They actually came from all over the country. They came from Constantinople. They came from other places in Egypt. Synesius was from out of town, as were a lot of the other people who came. And she taught a very small number of men, and they were all men, higher mathematics so that they could kind of purify their mind, you know, and learn this more esoteric level of philosophy that she was teaching.
Well, we should point out that philosophy then was different. It was different than philosophy is viewed now.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, philosophy as it was done back then was really closer to a religion.
Right.
And some of the other philosophers who came before Hypatia, and there were like several women philosophers who came before Hypatia as well, actually learned things that supposedly allowed them to engage in divination, and they did like magic. I mean, that really that was considered part of philosophy. The point that Hypatia was teaching, she taught in the Neoplatonist school, and basically they believed that you could know God, and, you know, they called the One, you know, they didn't say the Christian God or, you know, the Jewish God or the Roman God, whatever, but just God. You could know the creative force through a series of actions, the way you live. So you lived a very pure life, you lived, you know, a moderate life and an ethical life, and then you went through a lot of mental training and, you know, a lot of work with meditation and this sort of thing so that you could know God. And I think it's actually kind of similar. I've never studied Buddhism, but I think it's similar, you know, to that background and other more meditative religions. So that's what she was teaching these men, how to know God.
So was she formally educated?
Yes, but in the sense of how people were formally educated at that time, which was there were schools, there were, but they were religious schools. So there was a Christian school, there was a Jewish school, there were public lecturers, and in fact, there's been some wonderful archaeology done in Alexandria lately that's revealed this whole series of lecture halls, which is probably where she taught. But she was probably tutored by her father and any of his friends and colleagues that he felt would be appropriate for her to learn from. So, you know, it wasn't like the kinds of schools that we came up through.
And was that unusual at that time as a woman?
It was. I mean, as I said before, there were other women philosophers. Mm-hmm. There were other women who were writers and did those kinds of things. But this was more of a class thing than it was a gender thing.
Right.
So it was, you know, upper class women could access these things, again, if they had the backing of their fathers or, you know, a brother or husband or whatever. But they were the only ones who basically had the leisure and the means to become educated. Women in general at this time, the vast majority of women and men, were desperately poor. You know, life was short and brutish. And there was a very tiny, maybe what we might think of as a middle class, that might be like shopkeepers or professionals, but the vast majority of people, men and women, got little or no schooling. And from a religious point of view, again, with the Christian church, you know, it was really only the more upper class men and sometimes women who were even able to, like, you know, read a Bible and you know, give homilies in the churches, that sort of thing.
Was she a teacher or was she a mathematician? Because those are two fairly different things, and it's very unclear as to sort of which she was.
Yeah, that's a very good question, because the mathematicians, again, have claimed her because there aren't very many women in history who have that mantle. And she, no doubt, could do the most complicated and higher level math that was known at that time. There is no doubt that she and her father were the foremost mathematicians in the Roman world, and possibly even in the world at that time, because the Chinese weren't doing that much during their lifetime. However, they were not kind of experimental mathematicians. They did not produce anything new. What they were doing was taking what had already been done in the past 1,000 years by others, and basically, they knew it, they could do it, and they were teaching it. So, yes, they were mathematicians in that they could do that math, and she could definitely do the higher math, and she could also teach it. But she was not, like I said, she didn't add anything much new to math, except for one little technical thing, which I just find fascinating. I had mentioned that her father gave her credit for helping him with a couple chapters in one of his books, where what they call commentaries are basically textbooks. So here's the work of a famous mathematician on conics or on algebra or on geometry. And the commentaries are basically laid out, you know, here's the information, here are the exercises and the proof. So they're textbooks. And in one of these, couple chapters, it's known that a different and more innovative way of doing long division was being used. That is accredited to Hypatia. And you got to realize that they're not working with Arabic numerals here, the
right
numerals we use. They didn't have a zero. They didn't have the 1, 2, 3, 4, you know, what we have. They used Greek letters. And which I guess if you were into algebra, you know, A equals, you know, kind of stuff, that's what they were doing. But she had a technical enhancement. But for the most part, she was teaching it, and she preserved it, and she preserved it through her writing. And it's basically her father and her commentaries that have, in fact, come down to us and got preserved by monks and Arabic traders and things like that. And without their work, you know, we might have had to start all over again.
And that's the thing that I found interesting in your book, is that even though she wasn't responsible for any truly, any discoveries, any important mm-hmm. scientific or mathematical principles, it doesn't necessarily lessen her historical impact.
I totally agree. I mean, I think she had a key role in preserving that knowledge, because during the time that she lived, it was difficult. I mean, I know we're going to be getting into a little more on the politics later, but it was very difficult. And as I said, most people were not educated. Very few were. And most people were not educated in math and science. I mean, they might study rhetoric or history or, you know, that sort of stuff. So very few people actually learned this. The fact that it got preserved, got taught, I think is a remarkable achievement.
You're listening to Science for the People, and we'll be back with Faith L. Justice to talk about Hypatia, her life and times, after this.
Science for the People is a weekly radio show exploring everyday life from a scientific perspective. To find out where Science for the People airs near you, or to listen to past episodes, check out our website at scienceforthepeople.ca. You'll also find links to connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, and Google+, or to subscribe to the podcast in iTunes. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Science for the People. I'm Desiree Schell, and I'm here with Faith L. Justice, freelance writer and novelist, and author of Hypatia, Her Life and Times. So are we able to figure out what Hypatia was like as a person? Is that possible with the scant amount of information about her?
I think we can draw some conclusions. I mean, we don't know. We absolutely do not know. But she is described as an upright person who, again, was participating in the politics of the times. She was chaste. She wore modest clothing. She was modest in her demeanor towards her students. And I think for a woman of that time, you know, she would have had to be a pretty strong character. She would have had to be stubborn. she would have had to have a lot of confidence. And so I think we can get glimpses of her as a strong woman who had the courage of her convictions. And much beyond that, probably not a whole lot. There is one story that comes down to us, which I find very illuminating. And this is the story of the minstrel rag. And this comes down through a little bit later writer who lived about 100 years after her, but again, might have had access to eyewitness accounts. And in this, she's teaching, and one of her young pupils has fallen in love with her because she is also believed to have been quite beautiful. So he's fallen in love with her, and he's been pursuing her. And she says to him, no, you have fallen in love with my outward form, my body. I need you to understand that the only beauty comes from within. And this was all part of the Neoplatonist, belief, like you had to have a beautiful, internal life. And so she handed him a used menstrual rag and said, this is what you love. And, you need to figure out how to do it right, because you're not supposed to be loving this. You're supposed to be loving, the internal beauty.
That is intense. That is the story that mm-hmm. if I would have thought that one thing about Hypatia was a myth, it would be that one.
But to me, because of its very crudity, because, there were attempts to actually kind of paper that over. Like, there was a second version of that story that said that she told the young man to go off and study music as a way of, assuaging his love. And I like the minstrel rag story because I think that is such a crude story. Why would someone make that up? that just has a ring of truth about it.
Oh, see, and that, to me, it smacked of myth because it was perfect. It is the perfect story.
I could see where you'd say that, yeah.
So what about, now we've mentioned it a number of times, and it's mm-hmm. it's time to talk about it, the political environment that mm-hmm. she was living in. So what was Alexandria like at the time?
Alexandria was a boiling pot, and it has been down through the years. I won't get into the history of Alexandria, but at that time, the city was very fractious, and in the larger context, what was going to become the Catholic Church was emerging from its several centuries of persecution. And even though Constantine, I think it was in 325, had tried to get some unity among the Catholic, what would become the Catholic Church with the Nicene Creed, had been unsuccessful. So from like 325 on, for the church was turning on itself because there had been all these people that had been persecuted. And so one group would say, well, if you would worship a Roman god to save your life, then you weren't a good Christian, and so you are not a Christian, basically. You had to have been pure. And then there were the other people who were saying, well, you could have an impure priest doing the sacraments and still be able to reach God. And people would disagree with that. It was lots and lots of little disagreements over almost every point of doctrine. So the Christian church was going through all these upheavals. And they were, basically, it was a power struggle. And, somebody would be up, and then the next 5 years, somebody would be down. And that's what they were dealing with. So in Alexandria, the 20 years prior to Hypatia's death, there had been a major purging of the Christians, and they were getting consolidated, and they were coming out of this kind of, all together. But there was still a big group of pagans, people who either were more Hellenistic, meaning it was more of a cultural thing rather than a worshipful thing.
Right.
And then there were also a huge population of Jews. one of the largest populations of Jews outside of Palestine and other places like that. These folks were all vying for power in the usual way that people vie for power. Into this mix gets thrown a brand new governor, and his name was Orestes. And so about 3 years before Hypatia is murdered, he comes, and he's trying to manage all these groups and manages to tick off nearly everybody, but particularly he manages to tick off the new bishop, who was a young man, kind of inexperienced, but the nephew of the bishop who had been in charge for 20 years or more. And his name was Cyril. And Cyril starts to take advantage of a lot of the chaos and start taking more of the secular prerogatives. There are ecclesiastical courts. He gets the Christians to come to the churches for all sorts of things. But he is also, wants influence over Orestes. And so these groups all clash over 2 or 3 years. And it turns out that Cyril manages to get the Jews basically expelled from the city. And the Jews did participate in that because they attacked Christians. So it was a lot of back and forth and back and forth. And in this whole mess, Hypatia was trying to mediate. And she came down on the side of, secular over religious, tolerance over dogma. And she was trying to take that middle road. And Bishop Cyril basically was losing and said, so how am I going to keep the power I've got and get more? He got rid of the Jews first, and secondly, he started slandering Hypatia. Because as I said before, Hypatia was of the upper class. The majority of people were very poor, very wretched, very superstitious. And he started sending messengers out into the churches that she was a sorceress, that she was engaging in black magic, that she had Orestes under thrall, a satanic thrall. Right. And basically what happened then was a suspicious mob led by a Christian, not Cyril, basically grabbed Hypatia out of her chariot one day, took her to a church, tore her limb from limb, hacked her up with either tiles or clamshells, we're still not sure which word, the word means both, and burnt the pieces of her body outside of the city.
So now the question is then, did Cyril eliminate a political rival, or did he eliminate a threat to the church?
That's an excellent question, and I don't think it's a clean answer, because from my research, Cyril seemed to be the kind of person who wanted power for power's sake. He was getting power through the church, and a lot of people did that. That's one of the things that happens when humans take over institutions, and particularly religious institutions. And we have incidents of that all down through the Catholic Church and every other church that's come through. So it's my belief and other people's belief that he wanted power for power's sake, but he was doing it under the cloak of religion. So you have a lot of people that look at the story and say, Christians did it. And yes, Christians did do it. But I think it was under the instigation of Cyril, who basically wanted to be the big man on campus in Alexandria.
Now, you are not the only scholar of Hypatia, amateur or not. So is there any disagreement amongst the people who study her and her life? Or are we fairly sure at this point that this is how it all went down?
I think we're fairly sure about the facts of, the political turmoil that led to her death. People do interpret it different ways. One of my major sources was Hypatia of Alexandria by Maria Zelska, and she's a Polish scholar. And a lot of people read her book and say, oh, she's being an apologist. The Christians did it. Why is she letting them off the hook? And, you know, I read her book, and I didn't think she left the Christians off the hook. You know, she said they had a lot to account for in there. So that's the reason why it's a muddied water. But I come down on the side that Cyril didn't do it because he had a religious revelation. I came down on the side that he wanted the power in the city.
When you say in your book that the evolution of Hypatia's mythology kind of reflects the changing themes throughout history, and I'm paraphrasing there, but could you mm-hmm. explain what you mean?
There, like I said, there were very few references to her, you know, but as Europe was going through their Enlightenment period, like in the 1600s and 1700s, people were starting to find these old documents, and there were references to her in what was called the Suda. This was a large encyclopedia, and there were, like, this is where Socrates things and another historian named Hesius, their stuff got summarized and put in there. So during the Enlightenment period, different people like Voltaire and Gibbons, who are some of the couple of the more famous names, would look at this material and say, okay, we're unhappy with the Catholic Church. The Catholic Church is corrupt. You know, Protestantism is moving along. And by the way, weren't the Greeks just the most wonderful people and had the very best of morals, and it was a wonderful golden time? And so they would look at the story and they would say, this is awful. You know, the Christians murdered this woman, and we need fell into the Dark Ages, and it's been like a thousand years of darkness since this happened, and it's all the Church's fault. So during the Enlightenment period, the Church was coming in for a lot of hate, and they reacted, and they wrote back, and they came up with their own tracts and defamed Hypatia in their own ways. But basically, we had poets, we had novelists, we had all kinds of people who took her story and romanticized it, and that's what has come down to us over the last couple years. Then, or last couple centuries. Then when, more recent times, as we said earlier, it was the scientists and the mathematicians and the feminists who took her on and said, you know, her story has something to say for us. And that's pretty much where we are now. There's still a lot of romantic thinking about Hypatia out there. I don't think it needs to be. I think she's an absolutely remarkable woman, just as she is. I don't think we need to layer lots of myth on top of her, but it's still out there.
Faith, honestly, wonderful book, and thanks so much for being here.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed this discussion.
You can find a link to Faith L. Justice and her book, Hypatia, Her Life and Times, on our website at scienceforthepeople.ca. And we'll be right back with Zara Zahari to talk about women's interest in science and tech fields after this.
When the United States Congress forced a 17-day government shutdown, nearly all federal research funding was put on hold. Now that the latest budget impasse is over, we'll discuss the lingering effects of that funding gap. On the next episode of Science for the People, we're joined by Andrew Rosenberg, director of the Center for Science and Democracy, John Sontag, instrument team lead for NASA's Operation IceBridge, J. Marshall Shepard, director of the Program in Atmospheric Sciences at the University of Georgia, and Casey Dreyer, advocacy and outreach coordinator for the Planetary Society, to learn how long-term projects were disrupted by the shutdown and how they're trying to recover. That's next week on Science for the People, on your local radio station, or online at scienceforthepeople.ca.
Welcome back to Science for the People. I'm Desiree Schell, and my next guest today is Zara Hazari. Zara is an associate professor in the Department of Engineering and Science Education at Clemson University. She was a National Postdoctoral Fellow of the Social Sciences and Humanities Research Council of Canada and the Harvard Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics. And her work on gender issues in science is currently supported by a National Science Foundation career grant and an NSF gender grant. And that work has been featured in Science Magazine, Live Science, and Scientific American. Wonderful to have you here, Zara.
Thank you very much, Desiree.
So let's just be broad. What is the state of women in STEM fields?
Well, I think that question would be answered differently by different people. I mean, there are lots of people who now come out and say that we don't have the gender issues that we had previously, so there's no problem anymore. But I think those of us who really work deeply and are immersed in gender research, we would say that there's still a very fundamental problem in STEM fields in terms of the participation of women, and in some fields more so than others. I think in general, there are lots of representation issues. And if there aren't representation issues, there's still culture issues. So in lots of the disciplines where you don't see, for example, differences in like the number of bachelor's degrees given to men and women, you still will see a gender difference at the highest end of the echelon. So at, you know, the highest academic end, at the full professor end, you know, in the medical sciences, you'll see it at like the highest paid surgeons are definitely underrepresented. The women are underrepresented. So you'll see it, you know, in other ways when you start to probe a little bit more deeper into the disciplines.
Well, and you mentioned that there's different levels of representation in different fields. Can you explain that?
In biological science, for example, we don't see a gender difference in terms of the number of women and men. And I'm going to use gender very loosely here. I'm interposing it, so please don't hold that against me with sex.
Right.
But you don't see those kinds of gender differences in terms of women's getting bachelor's degrees in, for example, biological science. It's at parity now, and actually in many places, like in the United States, women are overrepresented in terms of bachelor's degree recipients amongst biological science degrees. But in areas like physics and engineering, especially in North America, you still see this large disparity where women earn fewer degrees in engineering and in physics than they do in other disciplines. And, you know, that's something that's been consistent over time. And so there's still issues, but the issues are very disciplinary. So you can't just say it's in STEM in general, because STEM looks very different.
So now, so where are the trends heading from your research?
The trends in my particular research is that things are getting better in terms of representation. So if you think back to the 50s, we didn't see very many women in any of the sciences, right? So women were largely underrepresented in most fields, in most scientific fields and engineering fields. And it's been an upward slope in almost every single discipline except for computer science. Computer science is maybe the one anomaly where the slope has been downwards, where there have been more women represented in the past than nowadays.
Interesting.
Yeah, so that's an interesting field to study. But I think that in general, things are getting better in terms of women's representation. But representation is a very rough sort of estimate for, you know, what the climate is like, right? So back in the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, there was a lot of explicit bias. And a lot of that explicit bias has now become a little bit more implicit, right? So there's a lot of cultural issues that have resulted in a lot of those, you know. So what I mean by that is, back in the day, you know, if a professor or a teacher was sexist, right, he would make a comment that, oh, you know, this is not for girls. Whereas nowadays, nobody makes those comments. Very few people will ever make those comments. So women and girls going through school are walking around feeling insecure, but they don't know why they're feeling insecure. So what I mean is, a lot of that bias has become implicit. And so a lot of the things that end up happening in terms of like bad cultural climate happens, I think, because of that implicit bias that we don't recognize and will take a long time to fix, I think.
Now, this is where we get really into what I want to talk about, the really interesting part. What you're talking about is not someone's gut instinct about what the problems are. We've heard of a lot of sort of non-evidence-based opinions about that. So you've done research into these areas as to why there is less participation by women in STEM fields. So what have you found?
So in some of my... So I have a wide spectrum of research, but one of the most recent studies that we published, we were looking at what kinds of practices, and we were basing it on mythologies. So what kinds of myths that do people say help girls get into a physical science career? So physical science is an area, and engineering are areas that are where women are highly underrepresented. So there's all these myths about what could help, and hypotheses, I will say, what could help women get into these fields. And they range from role models, so having a woman teacher, physics teacher, seeing women scientists, having women scientists visit their classes, having women scientists examples presented to them. All of these kinds of role modeling type things have been posed as possible solutions. And the other thing that has been posed as a possible solution is separating the men from the women, that putting men and women together, women get marginalized because, you know, the men will receive more attention from the teacher, the men will dominate the conversation, even if the teacher isn't, you know, actively like soliciting their attention, that the men will tend to be more dominant and talk up and speak up and be more assertive. And so women get marginalized in those classrooms. So those are some of the hypotheses that people have put out. And from our work, we found, from our most recent study, we found that if for women who've had experiences in single-sex physics classes, there is no significant effect for their being more likely to pick a physical science career or be interested in a physical science career. So we found no effect for that. We found no effect, and I don't mean to sound depressing, but I'm going to tell you what we didn't find an effect for before I tell you what we did find an effect. So the other things we found no effect for was having a female physics teacher, for example. That made no difference to their likelihood of wanting to or being interested in a physical science career. Some of the other things were having women scientists visit their class had no effect. Having their teacher talk about women scientists, so people like Marie Curie, Lisa Meitner, Lisa Randall, some of these famous female physicists, that made no difference to their interest in pursuing a physics career. What did make a difference, what did have a consistent effect in our study, is if their teacher explicitly discussed the issue of the underrepresentation of women. So it was this more explicit attempt at connecting with the girls and with the women in the class, I should say, and having them really think about why are there no women, why might they be feeling the way they're feeling in the classroom, and not making it so abstract, right? Just giving, I think women are sophisticated and kids are sophisticated, a lot more sophisticated than we give them credit for. So just showing them pictures of scientists, I don't think has an effect on them, right? They know that Marie Curie can do it. They know that Lisa Randall's wonderful and she's brilliant, but that doesn't mean they want to do it.
Did these results surprise you personally?
Yes, they definitely did. Because we set out on this study, we asked ourselves, what are the hypotheses that that are out there about what kinds of things might get girls interested? And we found all of this literature on role modeling and all of this literature on like unsupportive classroom situations for women. But when it came down to it, though, in the ways we measured those things, we couldn't find an effect for, you know, like having a single sex experience. So making sure that there was no men in the classroom to marginalize the women, and then all these different forms of role modeling, we didn't find an effect. I think we have to become more personal in our connections with people, right? And this is a lot of the push in my work on identity, is looking at how we make these connections, strong connections with students, not just these abstract connections of showing them examples, but talking to them about what they feel and how they feel in different situations and what they think and, you know, how, you know, physics might fit into their worldview and fit into like what they want to accomplish in their lives, right? Those are much more meaningful conversations than just talking to them about the life of Marie Curie.
This is so interesting. Can you talk a bit about the study design? Because I know that's something that people are going to be curious about.
Sure. This was a large-scale national study. It was epidemiological. So what we did was we had a random sample of colleges and universities across the U.S., which we sampled. We had 40 colleges and universities, and they were randomly selected from a set of I think around 3,000 or so universities in the U.S., however many universities they are in the U.S. We got those numbers from the National Center for Educational Statistics. So we randomly sampled those schools, and we contacted their English departments, and we asked their English professors to give a survey. So it's a complicated design, because we wanted to get the girls, the women, rather, who've had good physics experiences, as well as those who've had bad physics experiences.
Right.
right? So you want to get the people who say, I hated physics, I never want to think about physics again. And those people say, I absolutely enjoyed it, loved it. And so we needed a broad general population. So we sampled college English students and we surveyed them in the course. And we asked them about their high school physics class and what happened in their high school physics class. So these are mandatory college English classes, like for first year students. So we had a general population. Most of them were in their first year reporting back on like either their second to last year in high school or their last year in high school when they take physics here in the U.S. So they were reporting back and they told us whether their teachers had women scientists come visit, whether their teachers discussed underrepresentation, whether, you know, all of those things, hypotheses that we had posed. That was the design. And our sample was 7,500.
So have these results been controversial? Because I can imagine that they might be.
Well, we just published the survey, and I was going to put a press release out fairly soon, as soon as the official final release is out. So I'm guessing they will be controversial. I gave a talk about this at the American Physical Society a few years ago, and they did a press release, and it was picked up by Life Science. And we didn't get much backlash to it, to be honest. I think people know that a lot of these strategies are not working. I think the most threatened will be like the programs that, you know, advocate, you know, sending, these big programs in the United States and Canada that have scientists visit classrooms, mm-hmm. right? As part of their, so a lot of scientists, as part of their grants, they put in these educational outreach pieces where they say, oh, I'm going to go into the classroom and I'm going to talk to these kids about science, right? Those programs don't really have a good assessment component. And I think it'll probably be more threatening to those kinds of programs than anything else, because, you know, it'll question the veracity of, you know, the impact that those kinds of things can have on kids. Like a one-time only visit from a scientist, you know, it could have some amount of impact, but it's likely going to have an impact on students who already are interested, right? So I haven't seen very convincing evidence that those kinds of programs are very useful if you control for students' prior interest.
You're tuned into Science for the People, and we're talking to Zara Hazari about gender issues in science. Now, how would you study sort of the level of implicit sexism?
In terms of implicit or explicit?
Implicit.
Implicit sexism. Well, that's a really great question, and I actually have some other research that relates to that. Plus, I can talk to you about like research that other people have done. But you know, the idea of sexism that it's become so implicit that it's almost more troubling than it used to be, because you can't identify it. Like women can't identify, oh, this person's just being sexist, or you know, because it's not that clear. So one of the ways in which we found that is we did this study where we looked at student evaluations of their teachers, and we found that consistently women physics teachers were underrated by their students, regardless of what they did in the classroom. So regardless of the types of techniques they were using in the classroom, and they were just as likely to help students get interested in physics, and they were just as likely to help students persist, so take another course in physics. So they were good teachers, but these students were consistently underrating their female physics teachers. Now, I know Eccles has studied the opposite way around. I think it's Eccles or Riegelkram, I can't remember, but they studied it the opposite way around and found that teachers also, like in mathematics especially, they found that teachers tend to overrate the abilities of their male students over their female students. So there's bias going both ways, and I'm sure there's lots of studies about peer-to-peer bias. There's a National Academies of Science report that reported on another study of evaluation bias when people are looking at journal articles. So like this bias, when you know an article is written by a woman, it's still there. So having a reviewer review two different articles, one by a woman, one by a man, even if it's exactly the same article, the woman's article will get underrated in comparison. So, I mean, there's all of this implicit bias that unless you do these larger scale studies, you can't see it, but it's there. there.
Do you care to hazard a guess as to why?
Well, I would say all of these fields are fundamentally gendered. And what I mean by gendered is inbuilt in the field themselves are these biases. And so even, I mean, there's the bias that people hold subconsciously in their mind, right? Even if they think they're not prejudiced, we're all biased and prejudiced in some way, right? So there's a lot of people who believe they aren't biased, but those sort of plays out subconsciously, their stereotypes, you know? So a female student might say, I'm not biased towards women in physics, and then underrate her physics teacher, right? Compared to a male physics teacher. Like on the larger scale, you see that effect. So I think these underlying prejudices that we have that we're not even conscious of. But also there's sort of an inbuilt bias in STEM fields themselves. I mean, these fields were developed by men. You know, they were all of the norms and practices and things that are valued in these fields were standardized by men. And so there was no women's voice. There were no voice of racial minorities. There was no voice of other marginalized populations to say, this is what it means to be an engineer, or this is what it means to be a physicist. Right? So you see this in physics departments a lot, where women are just as capable and, you know, they are publishing just as much, but the area of research they're working on is just not as valued in the department. So for example, they might be working in biophysics, right, rather than in high energy theory. And so biophysics by that community is just not valued as much. So their work is valued more by like medical practitioners or other people outside of physics. So they're left feeling a lack of belonging in their own communities and feeling alienated. And they can't point their finger at any specific person necessarily who's doing it, but it's the inbuilt inherent bias in the field itself because of the socio-historic legacy of how it developed.
Well, now, how does this compare to other countries then? And I'm thinking of a number of things, and I know this isn't necessarily your field, but I'm wondering about your impression of this. Do we see greater STEM participation among women in countries that remove economic barriers to post-secondary? Things like offering free tuition or universal child care. Is there any connection, do you know?
I can't speak to economic barriers necessarily or universal child care. I'm sure the European countries would be a good comparison, but I don't know the numbers in the European countries as well. Actually, most of the European countries show the same kind of gender disparities that we see in the United States, the same trends that we see in the United States and Canada. The countries that are really surprising that show smaller disparities in fields like the physical sciences and engineering are places like Iran and India and Turkey. So those countries actually, you know, where you'd think, you know, there's this bias or there's the stereotype where women are marginalized in those countries, that they would be marginalized towards education and towards, you know, these kinds of fields, it's actually not the case. In Iran, for example, in engineering, you see very close to parity in terms of women's participation. And I believe the Iranian government had to put a cap on it. But don't take my word on that. That's something I have to look up. But I believe the Iranian government did put a cap on the number of women who they could place within engineering programs because there were so many women who wanted to become engineers. So this is more of a problem, I think, in the westernized countries than it is in some other countries. And my hypothesis about that, about why that is because I think in those other countries, it's not that child care is provided. It certainly is not. It's not because economic incentives are given by the government. They certainly are not. It's because I think women see engineering as a way of bettering their lives, right? And the stereotypes with respect to engineering are not there. So, you know, in speaking to many, many Iranian students who I've known over the years, both as my students and as colleagues and et cetera, you know, they sort of articulated that we don't have this gender stereotype where there's this idea that women can't be engineers or engineering is a masculine enterprise. Many of them said it was very shocking to them coming here and suddenly facing that it's seen as that, like more of a masculine enterprise, whereas those gender associations are not there. So I think it has to do with stereotypes and with economic mobility, that these women want to be more self-sufficient in those societies.
I feel like a lot of the information that you're giving us right now is quite contrary to what a lot of people think about women in STEM and some of the reasons for their lack of participation participation, let's say, within North American STEM fields.
I know it is. The numbers are shocking.
Science. Okay, so I guess the big question is, what can we do to, at this point, to attract women into STEM fields? What have you found is the most effective then?
Well, I mean, I gave you one example of a study, but just discussing underrepresentation is really not, it's just one sort of minor strategy that teachers can use. But I think one of the bigger global issues, and researchers like Amanda Diekman have really worked on these ideas, and also Jackie Eccles and others, is this idea that there are perceptions and stereotypes about certain fields that, you know, pervade our society. And those stereotypes have repercussions on, you know, women's choices. And I think one of the stereotypes that you think of in terms of the fields that are really, women are really underrepresented, like physics and engineering, is that these things deal with objects and not with people, right? And women, much more so than men, and many studies have found this, want careers, want to do things in which they can either help people or they can work with other people. So they want to be interacting with society and human beings, etc. And they perceive a lot of these fields as not affording those opportunities. And it's absolutely not true, right? There's a great article by Green in Science talking about the death of the sole author paper in Science. People never in scientific fields work in isolation, right? They're always working with other people and thinking with other people and discussing with other people and presenting to other people their findings. So it's a very, very social enterprise, but it's not seen as such. It definitely is, physicists definitely help society. There's biophysics work. Biophysicists, for example, work on the physics of cancer, you know, and things like that. And engineers work on all kinds of societal problems and societal issues. So I think they're just not branded that way. So that's one issue, that they're just not perceived as affording the opportunities to do the kinds of things that girls want to do. So we have to change some of those messages that we are sending to students. And I think that's really important on a bigger scale. And then the other thing is just helping students be recognized a little bit more. So from my identity work, in order for somebody to build an identity towards a discipline, so feel like that's something that they're good at and that they're interested in. What if I had to summarize it in, for example, a math identity, I would say you feel yourself to be a math person. So in order for somebody to feel that they are a math person, they have to not just be good at math, they have to also be recognized for it. So we have to also give that meaningful recognition to women and girls as they're coming through the pipeline, as they're coming up the academic ladder through school, that, you know, they are good at these things and recognized in meaningful ways. I'm not talking about just praising them all the time for everything. I mean, giving them challenging problems and then recognizing them when they, you know, rise to the occasion. And so that kind of recognition in all of our research, we see that women feel much less recognized in physics and mathematics in a lot of these fields than men do. And guess what? They're also underrepresented up the pipeline in those fields.
So do you think people will adopt the kinds of methods that you're proposing?
I certainly hope so. That's why I do it. I mean, I definitely advocate for coming back to practice. So, you know, a lot of our work, we are always presenting to teachers and interacting with teachers. You know, I do workshops and lots of other things like that to try to bring it back to practice, because I think doing research in a box is really not very helpful. Our goal is to try to change things and move things in a new direction. So, you know, for girls, it's really sort of fundamental to start to stimulate their interest in these fields, not by changing girls. This is the important point. We don't want to change them, but we want to change their perception of what the field is, right? And by doing so, I think in the future, what we'll end up doing is changing the field itself, because more and more women will be like, oh, this is something I can do. And then they'll get there and they'll say, oh, I need to change it to really fit my desires and my goals and my expectations, right? And so you'll see these fields changing. I mean, 50 years ago, you'd never see biophysics in a physics department. And now you see it, you know, all over the place, where biophysicists reside within physics departments, geophysicists also, atmospheric physicists also. Those guys would never be in physics departments 50 years ago. So, and I think the same goes for engineering. I think as we bring bring in more people with greater sort of with a broader sense of what they want to do and their goals and how they want to impact the world, those fields will change to suit those people, which is exactly what should happen.
Zara, absolutely fascinating work. Thanks very much for being here.
Okay, thank you. I hope the listeners enjoy it too.
And we've linked to Zara Hazari and her work on gender issues in science on our website at scienceforthepeople.ca. And while you're there, please do click the links to Twitter, Facebook, and Google+, so that you can keep up with all the latest show news, and to iTunes, where you can listen to past episodes, subscribe to the program, or leave a review. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week on Science for the People. Science for the People is recorded in Edmonton, Alberta. The show is produced by Rochelle Saunders. Ryan Bromsgrove is our promotions manager. Our social media manager is Chelsea Butler. K.O. Myers updates our website. Helen Quivillon is our publishing liaison. Ed Haynes is our guest coordinator. We get research help from Josh Witten. The show is edited by K.O. Myers and Ryan Bromsgrove. Our theme song was written and recorded by Fractal Pattern, and its title is Binary Consequence. The show is hosted by Rochelle Saunders, Marie-Claire Shanahan, and me, Desiree Shell.